Hi, I'm Andrew, and I'm making my grandfather Vertuca's spaghetti and meatballs in Parkridge, Illinois. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, Andrew. That sounds delicious. This is definitely meatball weather. Good morning. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I'm Mike Steven, and this is show number 798. What we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. And of course, you can find us all online, the usual spots. We're over on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook. And of course, be sure to hit up the website for the show, OutsideTheLoopRadio.com, as well as WGNRadio.com. Lots of audio there for you. You can dig into the audio archives of this program. And if you don't do so already, subscribe to the podcast of the show. It gets delivered to your device for free each week. Did I mention it was free? Yay, podcasting. It's the thing of the future. All the cool kids are doing it. Speaking of cool kids, Bob Ferguson is our engineer in the WGN Radio studios today. So good morning to Fergie. And yeah, this is meatball weather. If you're thinking of hunkering down, cooking up a big old meal, a big feast, maybe. Meatballs for sure. That works. Maybe a casserole of some sort. This is the weather for that. And because we're seeing some snowfall recently and the bitter cold temperatures, especially earlier this week. Do you remember that? Oof, how cold everything was. Still nothing compared to the polar vortex of 2019 when we were looking at minus 28 real temperature, then minus like 50 wind chill. But, you know, this was circulating online. This is not the first time I've seen this, but people in Chicago were saying, look, we're getting the snow now. The cold temperatures are rolling in. Wouldn't it be great if we had some sort of municipal service that would shovel the sidewalks? Because in Chicago, I think most of us know that what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to shovel our own sidewalks in front of our homes. And so not everyone does that, of course. and I should say many people do, and some do it with varying degrees of success. What passes for shoveling, I don't know about that. But people online now, especially on Twitter, where all the great conversations go, mainly to die. But anyway, I saw this on Twitter. People were saying, look, City of Chicago, could you maybe introduce some sort of municipal service that would be a snow shoveling service? So just like how we have plows that plow the streets, could we get people out and plowing the sidewalks? And by the way, the alleys, because the alleys, oh, you know, if you have a garage in the alley, even if you shovel out your space, you know, right outside of the garage door, you pull your car up, but you have to get down the rest of the alley. And that is like a roller coaster. It's like, you know, it's an amusement park ride. You're sliding side to side. You can't stop. It's insane. You're wondering why you live here. And so I know that would be extra work, and I know that would be extra money, but I always feel like in Chicago, we can find the money. I feel like a lot of times we say we don't have money, but then the money appears, right? There's some settlement, there's some lawsuit that the city council approves, and all of a sudden these millions of dollars show up. So I think that the money is there, and this could be a service, or these could be services that residents could really use, shoveling the snow on the sidewalk and taking care of the insane alleys. Because sometimes I feel like, you know, taking my life in my own hands if I'm going down these alleys and walking on these sidewalks. Just an idea. I support that. And I, again, the money's there. You know, we'll find the money. So if you can, get out there, shovel your sidewalk, clean it off, throw some salt down. It's going to be all right. The alley? That I can't promise you. It might not be all right. Well, we have a great show lined up for you today. We will talk to local journalist V. Harrison about her new book about Black life in inner city Chicago. Also, we will learn the secret history of a very cool blues guitarist, the late, great Sammy Lawhorn, and get an update on beautification in North Lawndale. Shovel that snow or get a snowblower. Local journalist and author V. Harrison has a new book out right now called Hood Healing, interviews with some of Chicago's most prolific voices in media and black culture. In the book, she exposes the impact of generational trauma on black people living in urban Chicago. The book features stories and interviews with local journalists and media influencers and is available right now on Amazon.com. V. Harrison is with us here on Outside the Loop to talk all about the book. V, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
You are quite welcome. So I know a lot going on with you right now, so let's get to it. So the book, again, it's called Hood Healing. Mm-hmm. Tell us why you put this book, this project together. How did it come about?
You know what? Over the last decade, the violence in Chicago and the crime rates has been atrocious. I would say that the peak of that and what we really began to see after the murder of George Floyd and after the riots that impacted the inner city was just a lot of influx of violence and despair. Then the city got hit with COVID, which was, as I talked to you about last year on your show, a detriment to black and brown communities who are already suffering in the city. And so Hood Healing came about because it's absolutely necessary to start having these conversations and actually tending to these conversations about the traumatic experiences that black folks experience in urban Chicago every day.
And this book really, you know, like you say, it puts the spotlight on that. And you have first person accounts, you have interviews with some prominent black Chicagoans who tell some really personal stories about how this generational trauma, as you're calling it, really makes an impact on them.
Absolutely. The foreword is written by MTV News host Domel T. Pungo. And in the foreword, Domel T. breaks down his experience working with a young generation that just is hopeless. You know, and he and I together tell a story in Chicago of just that, being Chicago kids who experienced this hopelessness. And as journalists telling these stories, usually for other people, he and I joined together to tell our own stories. Also in the book is former Chicago Sun-Times reporter Evan F. Moore, who's currently with Chicago Public Schools. Evan talks about his experience growing up on the south side of Chicago and the traumatic experiences as a young boy, and literally said in the book that despite his degrees and being an author and award-winning journalist, when he steps out into the world as a black man, he's an equal threat as any other black man. And so the exposure and the vulnerability of these people in my book, Sylvia Snowden over at Can TV, Emmy Award winning Gerard McClendon over at Chicago State University, also Dr. Tanya Sorrell over at Rush University, who really helps intertwine the psychological and psychiatric impact of trauma in black people. And what we oftentimes don't realize is connecting to the trauma that we're living day by day. And it started all the way back in slavery times when Africans were enslaved and brought over to America.
Yeah, and some of the folks that you mentioned right there I've had on this show, I mean, Domitee's awesome. I used to work with him at WGN, former WGN radio anchor and, you know, occasional guest on Outside the Loop. And he's a great guy. And he's gone on to do some really incredible things with MTV. So
absolutely,
he's doing really well. But again, you know, I think that despite sort of the what's going on the outside, that sort of veneer, you know, the trauma that you're talking about here, these experiences and the legacy of institutionalized racism is very real. And we see it, I think, you know, rear its ugly head, I suppose you could say, and that's a more tangible every few years. It's a more in some more tangible form, but then we kind of forget about it, you know, and that doesn't mean it's not there. It is. And I think that it's important to keep this story alive and understand that even though we've made progress, even though there has been a lot that we can celebrate, there's still some long-lasting challenges here, aren't there?
Absolutely. There are challenges that our own children will face. As Donald T. and Evan and Sylvia and I tell our stories, there are challenges that other people will face for the rest of their lives. Also featured in the book, Mike, is my own mother, Sandra Harrison, a longtime Chicago native, a mother of six, and the mother of my brother, who was just slain on the West Side just this time last year. He lost his life to this Chicago violence. And so one thing that I really was adamant about doing, a huge shout out to my editor, Dina Chapman, over at Precision Editing LLC. Dina really pushed for a solution-based content in this book. And in addition to the interviews and the research, I offer tons of solutions as to what needs to happen to really address this trauma. We have to teach it properly in our schools. We have to get to the head of the table with people that are change agents. We have to hold our political officials accountable all the time. You know, and that's super important. And my publishing company, which is a small in-house publishing company, Thought Collection Publishing Company, ran by Kathy Lahr, the publishing company's goal is to be a voice in a different narrative and a change agent for Chicago and small inner cities. So it's really important that this conversation not just starts happening, but it's important that this conversation gets some balls rolling towards some serious change in this city.
Yeah. And I think, you know, change is possible. I think that the moment we don't think that change is possible, that you might as well just wrap it all up because that's it. So, you know, I think throughout all of this, what's coming through is that you still have hope. I mean, you're fighting for a better city. You're fighting for a better society and to try to overcome these racial divisions that have really just plagued us for generations. And we see the effects of that. But at the end of the day, these stories, I think, offer hope that change is possible, but we have to work at it.
We have to work at it. I'm so glad you said that, Mike. Also in the book is Natay Thompson, who is the co-founder of True Star Foundation and works with young people throughout the entire city, who are really the people who have their finger on the pulse of change. They are the revolutionaries. They are the activists. They are the young people walking out of their classrooms, demanding for better conditions, demanding for better education. That's the change right there. Those are the people who really need this book. Those are the young people who really need the support and need us wrapped around them in a way, because society really is telling them that it doesn't care about them. And the more young Black people who feel like they are not being cared and loved for, the more we'll lose to the streets of Chicago. And I'm just tired of having that happen, Mike.
Yeah. And I think really, for me at least, you know what, again, I'll just echo it. What comes away is that sense of hope. Is that really a big part of what you want to convey to the audience of this book called Hood Healing?
Hope and doing, you know, because hope is a feeling. I want action from Hood Healing, you know, and that is one reason why in chapter 5, my readers will find that it's extremely important that I offer some actual solutions. And I hope that it really creates some movement in the streets of Chicago. I'm going to follow up with talks all year long. I'm going to go to different inner cities and share these messages, because this isn't just a Chicago issue. It's a Black issue in Baltimore. It's a Black issue in Miami-Dade. It's an issue everywhere in inner city urban communities where there's Black and brown people who are suffering and who are hopeless and who needs movement in their cities. I'm hoping to be that voice, Mike.
So V, if we want to get a hold of the book, what's the best way to do it?
Go right on Amazon. It's available for you right now. Electronic Kindle version and a paperback copy. Just go right to Amazon, type in Hood Healing by V.L. Harrison. There you go.
Well, I really appreciate all of your hard work, V, and for you talking to us today. This is a really important issue, and we have to keep talking about it because this is really affecting a lot of folks, not just in Chicago, although certainly we have our own issues here with the issue of race, but across the country, as you mentioned here. The book is called Hood Healing, Interviews with Some of Chicago's Most Prolific Voices in Media and Black Culture, and the author is local journalist V.L. Harrison. V, thank you so much for talking today.
Thank you so much for having me as usual, Mike. Thank you.
like today, especially during this time, there is a lot of doom and gloom out there, but it's always nice when I think we can talk about some good stuff that's going on in our community. Coupled with the fact that from time to time, I like to give some updates on previous segments that we have aired on this show. So last year, March of 2021, on Outside the Loop number 754, I had a conversation with Pastor Rashorna Fitzpatrick. She is the executive pastor of the Stone Temple Missionary Baptist Church in the North Lawndale neighborhood in Chicago. And she is also part of the North Lawndale Community Coordinating Council. She chairs a committee called the GROWS Committee that stands for Greening, Open Space, Water, Soil, and Sustainability. And last year, we talked about how in North Lawndale, Chicago really failed to put garbage cans, public garbage cans, on the sidewalks. And, you know, that's one of those things I think we take for granted. You're in a neighborhood and you got to throw something out. Odds are, if you're in many Chicago neighborhoods, you can find a garbage can and you can toss something out. That was not the case in North Lawndale. And I think that this ties into the previous segment that we heard on this program when we're talking about disinvestment in some areas in Chicago, specifically communities of color. And I think North Lawndale, being one of those communities, really was sort of on that end of that disinvestment. So I had a great conversation with Pastor Rashorna. Here's a clip. Again, this is from March of 2021. This is from Outside the Loop 754. Let's roll that. I think we have some fancy harpsichord music to get us into the segment. Okay, let's start with these garbage cans. I mean, some of us might be surprised to hear that a Chicago neighborhood didn't have garbage cans on public streets, but that was pretty much the case. And you and others had to advocate for these garbage cans, didn't you?
Yeah, so the advocating started prior to me being a part of the GROWS committee, but I'll give credit to Mamie Gray. She is also a part of the GROWS, but part of the North Lawndale Greening Committee. They've been fighting for some years now for garbage cans, and we've all jumped into the fight, and we love our alderman. He made it happen, and we are celebrating. I mean, who would think that people would be celebrating for garbage cans? Well, we are in North Lawndale.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, you know, when we put this in sort of a larger context of Chicago and the history of Chicago, I think that when we look at a neighborhood like North Lawndale, and for so long you didn't have these public garbage cans, do you think that this issue speaks to a larger issue of maybe the priorities historically of the city of Chicago?
Sure. Many of the communities where Black and brown people live are disinvested. So there's not a lot that have been given to us, even though in these communities we should have everything that everybody else has, but it doesn't seem to always happen that way. And what should be normal seems so hard to come by. So, yeah, the city of Chicago is just kind of difficult when it comes to getting the correct services. And, you know, I said a minute ago, who would think that people would be happy to get garbage cans? Well, this is a community that not only needs garbage cans, but a lot of other things that other communities have that we should have, but we yet don't have. But we're still fighting. And I think fight is a strong word. We're still pressing in to get the things that we need. So I'll say we're still in the press.
The full court press.
Full court press.
Again, that clip, Pastor Rashorna Fitzpatrick of the Stone Temple Missionary Baptist Church in North Lawndale from March of 2021 last year here on Outside the Loop. So really great work on the part of everyone advocating for change in the North Lawndale community, because last year more than 70 trash cans were added throughout the neighborhood. So that's good news. However, that still isn't enough, because there was a story this week on Block Club Chicago about how residents now are trying to create a campaign to make North Lawndale litter free. So apparently, and this drives me nuts, when people are driving around and they're throwing trash out of their window, I see that on the highway a lot. But this happens all over the place, and specifically, this is an issue in North Lawndale. And so a lot of folks in that community are fed up. They want a cleaner, litter-free North Lawndale, and this GROWS committee is working on plans to try to reduce the amount of garbage, the amount of litter that's blown around the streets and the community of North Lawndale. So that is something that is currently in the works, and I think that is necessary. Actually, I think that's necessary in many other Chicago neighborhoods, because it is just crazy, especially when you see someone doing it. And in the story, it talks about how some residents actually go up to people that are in the process of littering and say, hey, what are you doing? Do you know, is that recyclable? Do you know what that's going to do to the environment? And I think to have that conversation can be a good thing. Some people obviously might be more receptive to that conversation than others, but this is something that people are thinking about, the responsibility of keeping the neighborhood clean in the neighborhood of North Lawndale. So I think that this is worthwhile. And look, it's great that the community now has 70 new public garbage cans as a result of the great advocacy work of the folks in this neighborhood. Now we just need people to use those garbage cans instead of throwing your trash on the street. So hopefully this is a little inspiring. Change is happening in North Lawndale. Let's follow suit. In the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Connecting across town once again to the lair of an apartment. The apartment of Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music. And we are in the winter blues. Boy, are we ever in the winter blues, Steve. And we've got this week this incredibly prolific blues man from, not originally from Chicago, but spent many years here, Sammy Lawhorn. And he just rips on guitar.
This was a guy, you know, my drummer recommended to me, friend and drummer, Jose Bernal. I asked him, like, Danny, you know, anyone you could think of off, he's kind of like a blues expert. And I was like, anyone you could, and he's like, man, one of the best Muddy Waters guitarists, Sammy Lawhorn, doesn't get any love. And boy, was he right, you know, like I could only find a few sources of information on him. There is a little bit of footage of him playing. And he is an incredible guitar player.
Yeah, you mentioned he played for Muddy Waters. I mean, that's awesome right there. But he also played with incredible other musicians that, you know, when we talk about sort of the pantheon of blues players, they're definitely in there. And it's another example of this, you know, this story of this kid from Little Rock, Arkansas, born in 1935, and he's coming up here, and eventually he's going to be playing with the big boys.
Yeah, and I should add too, and this is no small thing. Supposedly Muddy said he was like his favorite guitar player that he ever played with, or you know, he thought like the most skilled guitar player that he had. So that is a that's a pretty special distinction right there. So, yeah, he was definitely well-respected by his peers. But, yeah, you know, as a kid in Arkansas, he got to see some of the great guys mostly it sounds like coming up from Texas. So he got to see like Whiten and Hopkins, T-Bone Walker, Lowell Fulson, all these sort of legendary dudes. So he definitely got the right influences, you know, early on. Supposedly he got guitar tips or lessons from Big Bill Brunzi, who's like one of the absolute giants.
And so here we go. Sammy Lawhorn, he does this thing. This is like totally authentic, the blues story. You know, he builds what, like his own guitar out of like a string in a box.
Yeah, it was called a diddly bow. And it was, and they say Bo Diddley actually took part of his name from it. And it was a loose thing. You basically took some wire and you strung it on some kind of wood, and that was your diddly bow. And maybe you could tune it, maybe you couldn't. But the lore has Lauren do it on the side of his house.
He nailed it to the side of his house.
Nailing it to the side of his house and stringing some wire across that as his first guitar. But luckily, his parents, well, his mother moved to Chicago, and he was pretty much raised by his grandparents. And when his mother was impressed, you know, by his interest in the instrument, and he got to go from a ukulele to an acoustic guitar to an electric guitar. Thanks, Mom.
That's right. And he's basically, you know, getting some tips from folks. He's coming to Chicago to see his mother and his stepfather. And by age 15, he basically goes professional, playing the guitar in 1950. And he's playing, this is a great first gig, he's backing singer, guitarist, and harp player Elmore Mickle, also known as Driftin' Slim or Model T Slim. Elmore Mickle recorded with the likes of Ike Turner.
Yeah, super young. I noticed his credit on a single he had done. Yeah. And then after that, he was playing with Sonny Boy Williamson II. Both were famous, one and two.
yeah.
On the King Biscuit Time radio show, which is like beyond legendary. So yeah, he seemed to fall in with the right people. And then he pretty much went to go serve in Korea, but he ended up being more of a aerial photographer, I guess, and was wounded and pretty much let out of the service in like 58.
Boy, he's got some stuff going on in his life that's not exactly helping him along, despite the incredible talent that he has on guitar.
Well, yeah, he went to Memphis right after the war, you know, moved a little closer to Chicago and did some of his first sessions. And then I guess when he moved to Chicago, his guitar got stolen right away.
Of course,
at a gig. And then he still persevered and he hung in here and yeah, met up with Muddy Waters and pretty much played on some of his most seminal recordings.
So he's playing with Muddy, and that's a great gig that lasts like about a decade, basically. But unfortunately, Sammy Lawhorn, who we're talking about here, he had a drinking problem, and it wasn't getting any better. And Muddy Waters had to fire him in 1973 because, what, Lawhorn was basically passing out on stage?
That's, yeah, you know, lore has it kind of hanging over his amp and sort of passing out or not showing up to gigs at all. And, you know, I think it kind of broke his heart to let him go. But, yeah, I mean, he's still got work. I mean, he's playing with Junior Wells a year later. He's playing with Coco Taylor a year after that. So, and, you know, and before that, he was still playing with like John Lee Hooker, Otis Spann, Big Mama Thornton. So, you know, he managed to keep working.
He's playing with these great musicians. He's got some personal issues. So, okay, let's fast forward a little bit. I mean, we're talking about Sammy Lawhorn here. He's struggling with drinking. He's got some arthritis. So he's got these health issues that begin to drag him down. And this is insane. He was robbed in 1972. He was robbed in his own home. Tell us what happened here, because this is nuts.
The story has it they threw him out of his own window, and he was on the third floor, the burglars.
Oh.
So he like broke his ankles, and yes, it supposedly like exasperated, you know, his arthritis problem. That was in 72, so that was actually even before. Kudos to my editor for finding that day. We could not figure out exactly when all that happened, if it was like later in his life or not. So that was actually when he was still with Muddy, you know. So must have just been a rough time, that 72-73 period, you know. Yeah. He's drinking, body gets fired. But I mean, man, if you were suffering from all that, might be drinking too, you know.
Yeah, right. Well,
yeah.
He unfortunately dies relatively early. I mean, he's going to play a little bit more. He's going to appear with Pinetop Perkins, the great piano player, on an Alligator Records compilation. But he dies in April of 1990 at the age of 54. I mean, talk about like a blues, you know, story ending right there. Just so sad.
Yeah. I mean, he got to release one album under his own name, like in 1980, or on a French label. And yeah, he was working on more stuff. So it's sad. That's definitely too young, and definitely sort of a hard, tragic life. But, you know, this is what we think of with the hard living bluesmen, you know, who started off nailing a diddly bow to the side of their house, you know, yeah, in order to play. That's a hard life, you know. And yeah, getting thrown out of your own window too. But if you can find, there's some great footage of him playing with the Muddy Band. I think it was on B Club or something. You'll see. He's the man.
We should talk about briefly here his guitar technique. I mean, he's really good. He's got expressive technique. He's explosive. Muddy Waters said he was his favorite guitarist, and he was so talented on the blues guitar.
He had a sort of electric lead sound that, again, you can hear echoed through pretty much, you know, the next 40 years of rock and roll, you know, without people giving credit. It's a real biting kind of solos and tone that, you know, I think was, again, really pivotal. And the funny thing is, probably a lot of people listening to those records weren't necessarily aware of who the guitarist was on. I mean, he's on Muddy Waters' Real Folk Blues, which is probably one of the top 10 most seminal blues LPs of all time. But do you hear his name? No.
Well, let's say the name. Sammy Lawhorn is who we're talking about here. And you can go to chicagoreader.com or pick up a copy of the Chicago Reader to see the Secret History of Chicago music strip that is written by Steve Krakow. He also does a drawing of whoever he's profiling, and you can see the picture of Sammy Lawhorn, a great blues guitarist that was taken way too early. And you can get the whole story again at chicagoreader.com or in the Reader. Steve, hey, stay warm out there, and we'll keep those winter blues alive.
Play some of the hot, tasty licks of Sammy Lawhorn to keep you warm.
And that will do it. Outside the Loop show number 798 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. I really do appreciate it. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering help. Have a fantastic week. I'll talk to you again next time here on Outside the Loop.